Our next presenter comes from Humboldt County in California. Mitch Tackleberg will talk about something which is very important, although we usually don't think of it in the terms of open source and free software. It is about ballots and voting. And although the vote is secret, the voting process itself should be open, because that has something to do with the trust we put in the voting and the democracy itself. So we probably have to get this one.
Mitch Trachtenberg. I'm from Humboldt County, California. And can I just see a show of hands how many of you have ever heard of Humboldt County or Humboldt? Okay, we're actually fairly well known for two things. One is the quality of our pot, and the other is our ancient redwood trees. And both are really magnificent. And it's an area that tends to attract people who are not quite as much rule followers as many other people in the United States, and that's probably why our project emerged there. Throughout the United States, we've had a decade or two decades of voting machines coming into use. Now, once upon a time, things could either be hand-counted. I think somebody told me that in Norway, all the votes are hand-counted. I'm not sure if that's accurate. That's probably the ideal solution. That's not what we're using. We had been using a variety of different techniques, and then companies got themselves hundreds of millions of dollars with something called the Help America Vote Act, and that was going to get us touchscreen voting systems. And those touchscreens kind of closed proprietary software, which we're not supposed to look at, but that's okay, we're told, because they also generate audit logs, and there's no way that they're problems there, and they are of course certified by experts, and so how should we doubt them? Well, Humboldt County was not one of the places that switched to these touchscreen machines. We stayed with an older technology that used optical scan machines. But even so, the counting was being done by proprietary software, and one of the big advantages to using optical scan machines as opposed to touchscreens is that the optical scans by definition leave behind a physical artifact, the actual ballot, so they can be recounted. So there's been a great deal of demand by people in many jurisdictions for these systems to be the ones that are used. And one thing that occurred to us was it would really help the argument that these machines leave ballots behind to be counted if we had our own independent count of the ballots in at least one jurisdiction. So people have been trying throughout the United States to make this happen. In Humboldt County, because of the different culture here, our registrar was actually anxious to work with us. So the person in charge of the voting systems really liked the idea of doing an independent count as well. So the idea was actually proposed to her by a commercial fisherman, and she and he met for a while, and instead of her rejecting the idea out of hand as happened, she said, okay, if you can do it, then let's do it. They got together. I met her under completely different circumstances, and I've been trying to get this sort of thing to happen for some time, and so I was thrilled to help out. So I worked to develop a program that would do the independent counting of the ballots. It's a program called Ballot Browser. And we were able to buy a scanner for about $25,000 out of her office budget that would allow us to scan all of them. So we sat down, I'll begin with this little bit of history. We sat down and the Oslo PDF is going to be a file on that drive. And I think it's .sca6, I think it's too now, I'm not quite sure. So let's see, we were able to purchase this scanner and we were able to go ahead and do our account. And we did the count in May and everything went well. And so nobody ever heard of this. And it was more or less what I expected. I mean, we weren't expecting to find any discrepancies. Then, after May, when everything worked out in what's our United States primary elections, we wanted to do it in the main presidential election, which took place in November. And so we did. And as we got the ballots, the deadline for our registrar to certify the vote to the state officials came. And we finished scanning basically the night before she needed to certify her vote. She went ahead and certified the vote, but when we had scanned 192 more ballots, or actually a little bit more than 200 more ballots than were in the official count. And so we were all assuming it was our fault. We had done something wrong. If we hadn't done something wrong, then we were assuming that the county clerical people had done something wrong, had accidentally missed a set of ballots. Well, it turned out we hadn't done anything wrong and the county hadn't done anything wrong, but the vendor, the commercial vendor that had provided this proprietary software to do the counting had actually had a program that we'd been using that dropped the very first batch of ballots that were scanned in. This company is Diebold. They're the ones that make automated color machines. Yeah. And so all of a sudden, this turned out not to be something that we had thought we would be justifying the idea of optical scan ballots, but it turned out we had found they couldn't even count right when you had paper in front of them. And this went to the California Secretary of State, and the California Secretary of State did an investigation. Let's see here. It might well be Ms. Trachtenberg PDF. Let's try over to that and see what happens. That's a different one. Is there one called Oslo.pdf on there? Well, take that one.
I think there was one on the...
Yeah, there was one on a different drawing.
Any set of slides will do. Yeah, there we go. Oslo.pdf. But if you can leave me access to the other one as well, that would be great. You can leave me a window that would let me start on the page. Okay, so... Let's just, if you can bring that one to the full screen and show me a page down button. Yeah. You.
Does anyone have this one cut in
there? Yeah, I guess step five.
You.
You.
That's a lovely one.
As a platform, and then a little bit about the program itself. So I think I've touched on everything up to the where are the ballots, and of course, over there. So basically, what turned up was Diebold's system didn't work, and that was bad. So the California Secretary of State started an investigation. The California Secretary of State was the person who had told all California counties that they could not use touchscreens. A lot of the counties had already gone out and purchased touchscreens, and she didn't have the guts to tell them, no, they're decertified, you can no longer use them. So that was one reason that this mattered a great deal. We had just switched, the state had switched. People had to use these optical scan things, and so now her reputation was sort of on the line with the optical scan things, and it was turning out that they didn't work either. So they did an investigation, and they found that, yes, the version of the software that was in use in Humboldt County was an old version, 4 or 5 years old, and it's true. If you deleted a deck of ballots fairly late in the process, which was something that was always, it was very common in elections offices, if you accidentally missed a ballot or scan two twice, you'd have to delete that batch and start over. If you deleted that batch, then it would also silently delete the very first batch. And all of our 197 ballots turned out to come from one precinct that was the very first batch that had been entered. The California Secretary of State was able to determine that and then started looking into the audit logs, which shouldn't be called audit logs, because the audit logs, it turned out, had no record of any deletion of deck zero. It turned out that the deletion of decks, period, was not entered into DeBolt's Gen's audit logs. And as they went on investigating this, they found out that there was a button in the user interface labeled clear, and if somebody pressed that, it would wipe out part of the audit log. These machines had been certified by a federal body that was supposed to certify that none of this was possible. And so what happened was this little open source project pulled a thread and it turned out to be attached to something fairly large. Not large enough to get mainstream media coverage, by the way. We have been all over the blogs. We've been well covered by our local newspaper, which has a circulation of perhaps 10,000. But when you come to the national media in the United States, just about nothing. So let me move on to our process. Our goal was to use open source software from start to finish. The basic idea was that every line of code that was used from the very beginning to the very end should be open to public inspection. So the system that we used was a plain vanilla install of Debian Linux. We were going to scan all the ballots on this very high-speed scanner that took about 1 second. We maintained chain of custody on the ballots that were all deputized by our county clerk. We digitally signed the archives, we burned them to DVDs, and although we didn't, what should probably be the next step in the process is once you've burned the images to the DVDs, you should do a spot check back to the original paper ballots to make sure that the images that got burned onto the DVDs are the images that you bought got burned onto the DVDs. And then we offered the image collections on the internet with the idea that if you wanted to, you could do a count. I wrote some basic counting software so that we could do our own count, which is why we were able to rapidly turn up this problem. And so we provided an independent count. So we went with open source as a platform. We used Debian then. Now we're probably going to start with Ubuntu, which is just a Debian variant. But that gets us most of the way there. It provides a scan image as a program and an interface with a very wide variety of scanners. It gives us a graphical file system for people to use. It gives us an encryption or a digital signature program, GPG. One of the really nice things about Ubuntu is that there is now a graphical user interface on top of GPG called Seahorse. And so people who are not technically comfortable can have some chance with instruction of digitally signing archives. Also graphical archiving tools, so that using a very straightforward interface, you can develop a zip file or a tar file or anything like that. And of course, there was Python. And I knew Python, which is why I use Python. The advantage that we get by using plain vanilla, there are two advantages that we get by using a plain vanilla distribution except for the counting program. One is it would be very, very hard for somebody to secretly put software into an international distribution that was designed just to hack an election. Okay, so if we're just downloading a signed version of Ubuntu and use that as our starting point, then most likely no one is going to have introduced something invisibly that's going to hack that system for us. The other advantage is the rising tide is going to carry us. As the user interface is developed, we're going to get all of those benefits. We get transparency because people can know exactly what code is running. We have the ability very easily to turn off anything connected with networking or anything that we fear might be a security hole. As it happens, the machine that we used, we simply kept isolated with air. We didn't allow any networking on that machine whatsoever, and we loaded the Debian on from DVDs. No licensing issues, and no extra costs. Now, the count So, let's see. I've got the slides for me now. The deal is I can do a demo of the counting program if anyone has a computer with a working VGA output or video output and is willing to boot a DVD that's alive in Ubuntu system. So I'm just going to leave this here. And if any brave soul comes up, I can project it. Otherwise, you're welcome to come up at the end of the presentation and I'll give you a demonstration of it. Our goal was to provide the opposite of a black box. We wanted there to be an understandable intermediate output. We wanted the counting process itself to be visible with immediate visible results so that as the program is counting, it would be projecting the ballots on the screen and showing which areas on the ballot it thought had a vote and showing which vote it thought it was. And you could stop the program at any point and check back over the last few to see whether the votes that it was recording were the votes that you expected. Wanted the code to be understandable and open, and we weren't trying at this point to be all things to all people. We just wanted to have like 99% of the ballots be countable like this, because we figured we can count the other 1%. That's not a problem. Now it turns out this may be more general use, we want to get more accurate. But initially we were only worried about getting that 99%. But the philosophy stays, we're not as much worried about getting 100% accuracy as we are worried about reducing the scope of the problem from counting all the ballots by hand to counting the 1% of the ballots that maybe the program can't find. So we definitely want to kick out anything that we have trouble with and alert people to it, but we're not worried about getting everything done ourselves. And then one thing that was important, if this project was going to spread, we had to throw in some things that would give elections officials more convenience. Because if we didn't do that, then they wouldn't have as much of a reason to adopt this sort of software. So here's our approach towards using the program. A typical election in Humboldt County will have 16 or so different ballot types, where there are different municipalities or different elections, different propositions. And so we have to get a template for each of the ballot types so that we know where on the ballots the various votes appear. We have to develop a global contest and choice list, the same thing that the election officials are going to do with the proprietary software. They have to do with ours. They have to say, all right, we have a presidential race, and it's got these candidates. We have a representative race, and it has these candidates. And on each card type, they're located at these locations. So we developed a per template locations map that's done as an XML file for each of the JPEG templates. Then we go ahead and we count all the ballots, print a result summary, and provide detailed results for SQL or spreadsheets. So this is a simple interface for building the election contest list. Type in the contest, type in a series of candidates, get it, and delete them. Eventually, if the program expands to printing the ballots, which is something that it may well do, then this same information will be used for printing the ballots. Once you've done that, there's an interface that allows you to choose each of the templates, and the fronts of the ballots are just numbered either 1 or 0 through 15 or 16F, and the backs are numbered somewhat oddly based on the propositions that appear on them. This is just a point-and-click interface where you would click on an item in the list here and then click at a location. And because on particular ballots that we were using, things align with water-rich boundaries, we can just snap right to the location. Also, as it turns out, we don't need to be very precise. For the vast majority of votes, there's either a mark or there isn't a mark. And if you're a little bit off, it doesn't matter that much. So our approach is really, I mean, it's so simple it's almost embarrassing. We're not trying to determine whether semantically something is meant as a vote or not. We're just saying here's a dark spot, and we think it's a vote. Here's an example of the program itself running now that it's been loaded with the appropriate templates. Basically, we have organized our files into a file tree that was two directory levels deep, where anything from 0 to 999,999 would be represented by a six-digit number, and we kept it to 100 files in the directory, and 100 directories in the larger directory, and so on. So it's up to file 2 we're going from 1 to 2, it's up to 2. And it just looks for dark spots in the locations that it's been taught about. So these are all the voting opportunities, these black boxes that are superimposed on the ballot image. And this red box that says Obama is an example of a vote that it spotted. Here's another spot that Proposition 4 was a no. All of this is projected on screen. So in theory, although we didn't, in theory, you could have an auditorium and you could simply let these images appear one per second or slower, and you could have clickers where people would say, I disagree with that one. And at that point, that would be registered along with the other information in the file. This is a slider that lets you change the delay, how much time each ballot is left up on display. And at the end, it puts on screen what the vote count is. But actually, this vote count is not particularly important to us. The main output file, I don't think I have it. Let's see. Yeah. The main output file is just a CSV file. Again, it's so simple, it's almost embarrassing. What we put out is a file called votes.csv and a file called nonvotes.csv. And every time the system scans a ballot, it puts a line into votes.csv saying, okay, here's a ballot. And then every time it encounters a vote, that is an area that might have had a vote that had an intensity below a threshold, it writes out the content, the image, the contest, the choice that was made, the x and y coordinates of the choice, and the intensity on a scale of 0 to 255. Now, we set a threshold of 215. Anything below 215 would go into votes.csv. Anything 215 or above would go into nonvotes.csv. And how did we get that threshold? Well, basically, everything forms a double pump. The nonvotes are with these high intensities, the votes are with these low intensities, and there's a zone around 215 where only about 0.1% of the ballots enter that zone. So, once we have that we can say that there's a very good chance that the votes are going to be here, the non-votes are going to be here, and anything plus or minus 10 from here, let's kick that out for manual inspection. So what we end up with is nothing but a spreadsheet file. And that spreadsheet file can then easily be imported into either a free software spreadsheet program like Numeric, or more typically, a free software database like MySQL. And the import of our size spreadsheet files on really slow machines is less than a minute, and you can then go with any SQL commands you want. We didn't do up any special user interface for the database search, but that's a potential next step for the project. The last step is we have to have some way of sorting the ballots by precinct, and Diebold labels each ballot across the bottom with a series of dashes, and those dashes indicate which precinct and what card type, and we didn't know how they were using those dashes to map the precincts. So what we did was just put together a simple interface where every time you encountered a new dash pattern on the bottom of the ballots, it would take a snapshot of the upper left-hand corner, actually the upper right-hand corner of the ballot, which showed in text which precinct it was. And then at the very end of scanning, we asked the user to become an OCR machine for us. And so we show them, here's one that's 5MK4, would you please type 5MK4 for us? And they type and fill in all these boxes, and that gives us one more CSV file that can, again, be imported into the database and used in database joins to do precinct level vote counts. So I think I've just actually shown you all of the items that will be in the non-existent demo. Now, on the internals, what we used was Python as a programming language, and aside from the fact that I knew Python, Python also has something called the Python Imaging Library. And really, that made loading the ballots a one-line affair. We would just call Python Imaging Libraries image.load. Load the ballot in. We then needed to do some analysis of the ballots, but for the most part, the main call that we used was an image stat call, an image statistics call for the intensity, the average intensity of a cropped region. So that's it. For just about everything that we did, we would crop and check the intensity. And in terms of time, I mean, I didn't bring it, but on a Mac Mini, Ah, thank you. See how we're running out of time. It's probably almost time to be done, but let's do a quick demo so that you can see this work.
Approximately 20 minutes left.
Sorry?
Approximately 20 minutes left.
Oh, good, okay. Well, while this is going on, let me see where I was. Okay, the procedure that we would go through is with the Python imaging library, we would load the ballot, and then we had a couple of processes that we had to go through. All ballots began with a series of dashes across the top, so we had to go crop little regions starting at the very top and going down until we found a black dash, and then walk across until we found the end of the dash, and that would give us an upper landmark. Thank you. Squared up. It's actually perfect timing. Good model, actually, as it turns out, for the presentation. I believe it is starting up. We'll find out in a moment. Yeah, okay, so it's going in and it's retrieving a series of templates and then we'll put up the user interface. And what we'll see now is basically what I was saying, BC. So there's the interface, and I'm going to tell it that it's going to find its files anchored right in the directory that it's in already and ask it to go from 1 to 99. And so there we go. It's not showing you any overlay right now. I'm going to change it to show you the ballots that go by. And if we want to delay this, then it's just a matter of updating that slider so that we can get a good look at each of the ballots that go by. Now I'm going to pause it, and it's going to show me the last three ballots. So here, the first line that's going to have gone into that votes file is that this ballot was cast. And then on proposition one, we have a no, on proposition two, we have a yes, and so on. So anyone who has questions can see right at the time this is being projected whether or not the software is giving them an accurate result. Now let me enlarge this. Go into the terminal window. There's terminal applications, accessories, terminal. And enlarge this a bit. Not that way. I guess I'd better do it off the menu. Zoom in. We take a look at the votes file. Here's an example of what the votes file looks like. So there you have for image 1.jpg, the digit, 8x digit number that you see there is built from the dash pattern. There's a ballot cast, debug will be replaced by something eventually, and then you have the x and y coordinates and the intensity. Then for proposition 1, on image 1, the choice was proposition 1, yes. It occurred at 477, 157, and I guess the intensity was 69. And you can see for the votes, the intensities are all well below 215. So you get 69, 81, 90, 92, 87, and so on. Now, if we look at non-votes, it's the exact same format, but now you have 244, 240, 247 as the intensity values. And so now you can just take the non-votes file and filter it. Look for anything that's between 215 and 225 or so, which is going to be a very small number of ballots. And you can pull those out for manual inspection. Same thing with the votes file. You look at anything between 205 and 215 and say, are those really votes? Gonna pop back the other. See if it comes back.
One of the nice things about knowing the intensities
is you can distinguish accidental overvotes from real overvotes. That is, if one vote just had a little speck in its marking area and the other one has a big dark gash, then most likely the person really meant the one with the very dark image. And so you can actually develop rules that aren't arbitrary rules, rules that that can be accepted by all candidates for deciding when an overvote is an overvote, and they can be written down. You know, if there's a spread of 50 or more intensity units between the two votes, it's not an overvote, that sort of thing. When we check for votes, we check an area that is indicated on the ballot. So this would be a little voting oval, and this would be the candidate's name. And one problem that we didn't take care of in this round, but that probably will in the future, is there are lots of ways that voters mistakenly indicate their intention. The correct thing is to fill in this entire blue zone. It'll still work if they put an X through it, because that will give us enough of a mark that will pick up the intensity change. If they put just one mark through it, that's about where our boundary is, and that'll get picked up. But if they circle the area, which happens, we won't pick that up. So at the expense of slowing the process down a little bit, the next step is just to go ahead and take the yellow zone for anything that looks ambiguous or anything that looks like a non-vote in the blue zone. We'll take the yellow zone and see, well, maybe they circled it. And the way the law is written, whatever voter intent you can determine is what's used, not whether they followed the rules properly. So I've already mentioned enabling the review of the near misses. It's really important to record all the non-votes as well, because without that, you're not going to know whether there are near misses. And then I said earlier, you know, we just wanted to throw in some additional things for the registrars. It's kind of an endless list. But one thing that we did was decide, well, okay, every time somebody marks a write-in, they do that by filling in the spot on the ballot and then writing in a name. And as a convenience to the registrars, we go ahead and we capture each of those write-ins. Any vote that is indicated as a write-in is going to be captured, a little area will be captured, and we'll build a mosaic of it. So we can put out at the end of the race, we can put out a series of sheets, each of which have 30 of the write-ins captured, and they can look through them and decide whether they're valid or invalid. When somebody writes in Mickey Mouse, that's invalid. But when somebody writes in Hillary Clinton, if she's registered for that race, then that's a valid write-in. And so the key point here is we're asking for a group of people, some of whom are enthusiastic, but many of whom are very much not enthusiastic. We're asking for them to accept some change. And they're not a group that is incredibly receptive to change. And so we're giving benefits to all the participants. And the more benefits we can offer to them, the more they might be allowed to, or the more they might desire to switch. So the last few slides, there were a number of false challenges that we were presented with. The most basic of them was it can't be done. And this is so simple that I think in this room it's really hard for people to understand how that can be stated as a challenge without people giggling. But it is all the time. And because of the nature of proprietary software, it's my belief that people who are the potential buyers of that proprietary software are consistently convinced of the incredible difficulty in doing a task like determining whether or not there's a mark on a piece of paper. So the vendors encourage their audiences to believe that this is incredibly complicated software. Somebody told me that one vendor told them there were 3.2 million lines of code in their proprietary software. And there may well be, but 3.19 million of them are probably comments that were automatically generated. The equivalent of that is it can't be done for less than some numbers of millions. And actually, in the United States, there were hundreds of millions of dollars given by the government in grants to these companies to develop this software. It was called the Help America Vote Act. And I don't, you know, this is American politics, but the head of Diebold made himself famous at some point with a comment that I'm sure he he is not happy he made it. But at some point at a Republican fundraiser in the state of Ohio, the head of Diebold, the company that is selling these voting systems, said, "And I promise I will deliver the state of Ohio to George Bush." That's kind of bad. He probably didn't mean it the way people interpreted it, but nonetheless. And that it's too hard to use. And hopefully, you can see that with a GUI, particularly given that there are all these GUIs available for GPG and so on, that it really is a manual. It shouldn't be particularly difficult. So there are very easy solutions to the false challenges. Just do it. We didn't know that this was going to be used outside of Humboldt County, but we knew we had an opportunity that not many people were going to get. So we went ahead and did it. It turned out it's not, as you might guess, a huge effort. Once that's done, share it, let others improve it, and pray for money. We hadn't been thinking in terms of this being product for profit. But if there's money to be had, that would be great. I've started a company to provide the support and training and this sort of stuff. The biggest problem with praying for money for me personally is I'm an atheist. And that seems to be making my prayers not work very well. There are some real challenges, however. These are harder. These are real. There is an incredible problem around security versus convenience. Okay, we're asking people to do digital signatures, and the registrars want to not understand how digital signatures work, but not want any chance that when they push that button to make a digital signature, it will do something other than what they expect. And I'm not sure how to work around that. It's a real issue. Originally in the program, I think it might still be in the menus, I had something that when you chose to download the image sets, it would call GBG on your behalf to validate. And then I realized, well, no, we don't really want the program that's looking at these images to be the thing that's telling the registrar, yeah, these are the correct images. We at least want the registrar to run their own downloaded GPG implementation. But then you start thinking, well, how do we know that they're getting the correct implementation of GPG? And I don't have good answers to that. It's a real open question. And somewhat in the same ballpark is how do you enforce process requirements? A very large part of what our project did depends on people actually following rules that are written down. Okay? If you lose chain of custody on the ballots, then the entire thing is worthless. If you allow the machine to be connected to a network, the entire thing is worthless. And those are things that the software can't enforce. So they're really critical parts of the process, and I'm not sure how you enforce them. One thing that I'm thinking is, if this ever turns into just a CD that you're meant to pop into a machine, we'll probably include video tutorials on that PC, so that at least the people who are willing to pay attention will have it shown to them in a friendly way, as opposed to having to read a manual. And then there's the cheap hardware issue. I said very quickly at the beginning that we were able to get $25,000 allocated by our registrar's office for a scanner. And the problem is when people don't want to do something to begin with, and when the world is apparently financially crumbling, how do you get a registrar to come up with $25,000 in general? Well, the solution is make the equipment really inexpensive. And I know how you can do that, but I'm not a hardware person. I mean, you look at it, a digital camera is $100, and an inkjet printer is $100. And basically what you're talking about is putting a number on a piece of paper as it goes in, that's the inkjet printer part, and then taking a photograph of it. So really, when you think about it, the actual need is for equipment that costs maybe $200 to $500. But how do you get people to start mass producing that when they don't know there's a market? I don't know. I don't have an answer to that. And if you make it something that's free or that is very cheap, then all of a sudden the person who is procuring it isn't as important as they are when they're procuring something that's incredibly expensive. And that's a real issue. People gives out ski trips. It's hard to know how you argue with the registrar who's telling you that they don't want to do something because there's these 10 reasons, but the real reason they're not doing it is because you're not offering ski trips, and Diebold is. So those are real issues. None of them are software issues, but they're real issues that people developing any sort of open software are going to have to deal with. Next steps. The first version of this was one Python script without any intention of anything going beyond that. Now it's designed a little bit better to be more extensible, but it still needs much better extensibility. Right now we're using XML, but there's actually an XML, there's a language written in XML called collection markup language, EML, and we should probably switch to that. We'll add about layout and printing, because registrars have told us that the vendors charge them an absolute fortune for the incredibly complicated task of laying out their ballots. So perhaps that's one way of getting in. Right now we're just using MySQL, but we might develop a targeted GUI so that people can do database queries without having MySQL. These additional things. The most important next step is actually getting more people to participate. So far it's been a one-person project. The software side of it has been a one-person project. And so if anybody's interested in being person number two on an open source project, you know, here's your golden opportunity. So thank you very much for inviting me. This all has an Alice in Wonderland feel about it, to be talking in Norway about the local Humboldt County project. But I really appreciate your attention. If you have any questions, I'm glad to answer them. And if you are interested in anything, please come up and introduce yourselves. Thank you.
We probably have time for a quick question or two, if there's any. Yeah.
My name is Peter Reynolsen. One question: do you believe, what do you believe are the issues for electronic voting with touch machines or over the internet? Can you elaborate on that?
The question is, what's my opinion of the issues around electronic voting or internet voting? Purely my opinion is that there's no need for them. They're solving a problem that does not exist. And I think the idea of people coming to a location and filling out a piece of paper is a really good solution to the problem of elections. And the idea of voting over the internet seems terrible to me. It's just my opinion. I'm sure there are ways that you can develop extremely grandiose technical solutions to it. The problem with technical solutions is, even if they are correct, you know, even if the people in this room would go, wow, you know, that would be incredibly hard to break, I have a great deal of confidence in that, how do you spread that confidence to the population at large? It's a huge issue. So, anything else? Yeah.
Very simple. Why are you going to use SoundCloud later?
If you go to tevsystems.com, tevsystems.com, then you can click on a link there. Or if you enter my name, Mitch Trachtenberg, into a search engine, you'll come up with it. It's also on SourceForge. And I apologize in advance, it is not well packaged. But it is on SourceForge, and maybe somebody wants to package it.
Thank you for a very fascinating lecture on a very important question.
Thank you for having me.